And all September, coming into the new space, I want to talk about, maybe in a more focused way than I have in a little while, really around the relationship between Buddhism and particularly early Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, and the frameworks that the Buddha came up with, really that were that precede most of the yoga tradition as we know it. How those frameworks and how they've come to us in the 20th century relate with and don't in various ways what we call yoga now, primarily meaning a posture and breath-based practice descended from late Hindu esoteric mysticism. So Buddhism, what we call Buddhism and what we call Hinduism, and of course neither name was in use for most of their history, right? They're both kind of fairly late names of religions, and they weren't even considered separate religions necessarily for much of their history. But these two things that we consider to be related or parallel traditions start at the same place in the same time. They really start as different aspects of a complex, very dynamic conversation about liberation and the purpose of life, both beginning around several centuries before the Common Era. The Buddha lived in the 5th century or so, and the earliest texts on yoga of any kind that the mentions of yoga that start to arise in the Upanishads start to appear around kind of the same time, 700 before the Common Era up to, you know, 400 or 500. And that's the beginning of yoga, both in the stream that came to be known as Buddhism and the stream that came to be known as Hinduism. And there's a lot to say about this relationship and a lot of history intertwining. Tonight I want to talk about one particular kind of doorway in that maybe still has quite a bit of relevance for us as we practice today. A lot of folks who come to South Asian contemplative practice now come in the West, in America and Europe, in folks who are not Indian, as most of us here in the room, I think, are not, come to practice largely through one of two channels or pathways. One is through the practice of postures or asana, mostly through a Hindu yoga lineage or many lineages, and others through sitting meditation, often through Buddhist lineages. And these overlap in lots of ways, right? There's movement practice within the Buddhist streams, there's sitting meditation within the Hindu streams. But very often you have folks who find one thing or the other. They find Vipassana or Zen, you know, or Tibetan practice in the Buddhist lineages, and there's lots of sitting, you know, just sitting and sitting and sitting. And the movement practice consists of, like, walking slowly, and that's it. You laugh, but that's that whole world. And then a lot of folks come in through asana, you know, either through long-held poses, like in the Iyengar or forest systems, or moving dynamically through poses in vinyasa systems, like the systems that grew out of the Krishnamacharya lineage through Patabi Joyce and the Ashtanga system and other lineages. And for those folks, movement is a kind of meditation, but very often sitting in stillness is a very small part of practice, maybe a few minutes at most at the end of class. I have the strange good fortune to have begun both at the same time in very different ways. I first I started meditating just by moving into a Zen monastery because I figured all or nothing, right? So I shaved my head, put on a black robe, and was up at 4:30 a.m. sitting bolt upright, having no idea what I was doing, right? And they were just like, just sit. And I was like, what am I doing? And they were like, don't look around. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, geez, this is painful. And they were like, don't move. I'm like, okay. And then I was like, wow, this is hard. And they're like, wake up. So that was Zen for me. That was my particular. Welcome to Zen. I was 24 something, 23. And at pretty much the same time, I oscillated for a little while between Zen and grad school, just to say. Monastery, Ivy League, monastery, I flip-flopped. I ended up dropping out of the Ivy League before I dropped out of Zen. Eventually, I dropped out of both. But in the flip-flop, I went to grad school, and I took a yoga class at Cornell. And it was a Kripalu yoga class with this lovely, like, kind of hippie woman in long flowing skirts in this really dark room, probably because the lights were bad, fluorescence, in this like community center at the school. It had a carpeted floor. There were no yoga studios in town. And there was a lot of lying around, like, because you would lay down in between every pose, and we chanted a bunch to the deities, and we did a few poses, and it was very relaxing. And I was like, cool, that's kind of nice, like, that's great. And when I came to San Francisco, I started doing full Ashtanga. My dancer friends took me. And so for a while, for much of my practice, I would weave between intense vinyasa practice, and then I would go and do first Zen and later Vipassana, lots of sitting. And it's indicative of the split in modern practice that it never occurred to me that the two things were related. Or never. It took about 10 years for it to occur to me that the two things were related. I did them totally separately. I would sit in the morning and I have a whole Buddhist ritual. And then I would go to Ashtanga class and do the primary series and jump around and sweat. And it was just something else, right? I did this with my Buddhists and that with my dancers. And only after a long time did it... and maybe I'm slow, but did it start to occur to me that there was something similar about these two things? And when it finally hit me, it was like, you know, facepalm. But I was like, oh, they're both body practices. And I didn't get it at first, right? There's the sense in meditation that, like, I'm trying to calm my mind. And there's so much of, like, the mind gets distracted, bring it back. Watch the breath, but don't manipulate it. All these instructions in the sitting channel were largely mental. They were really like how you work with your attention. And then, you know, and the body was like, sit comfortably, sit tall. There's a little bit of posture instruction. And it was exactly the flip-flop in the asana world. Piles of posture instruction. Put your feet here, turn them out. Lift your kneecaps, inwardly rotate this thing, twist this thing that way, lift it up, breathe it this way. Do all of this stuff with your body. And then there was a little itty bit which was like, and concentrate your mind. And so it was sort of like, and as I started to learn history, it was almost like this tradition that was a body of practices that would serve to bring the attention and the body into a kind of intimate synchrony and breathing, attending, living, sensing, learning, inquiring union had kind of, when they came to the West, bifurcated into, you know, over here you sit in stillness, even if it's painful, don't worry about that, just focus your mind. And on the other side, it was move your body around a lot, and it doesn't really matter if you're distracted, but, you know, try to concentrate. And why that vast split happened, we could have a whole historical conversation about, and which is interesting, but the realization that finally was like, oh, this helps for me, was to understand that the physical practice was profoundly integrative in an attentional way, like. It was training me in this subtle way to pay attention to my body, to come into my body in all these ways that I had not been able to. And that the meditation practice was training the other side, the like, what does it even mean to come into the body, right? What is attention? What is awareness? And so if we think about these two traditions not as separate things, but as arising from one body of knowledge or body of investigation, we can start to investigate this interesting quality that we call, I'll put it in scare quotes, embodiment. What is embodiment? Right? Did anyone want to say, like, when I say the word embodiment, what does that mean to you? Someone, give me a definition.
To Getting your brain and your body in the same place at the same
time. Getting your brain and your body in the same place at the same time. This is great. What else?
Felt sense of the body.
The felt sense of the body.
Awareness of the body.
Somebody
embodies certain values or qualities.
It's almost like a value or a quality gets taken on or lived into through the body. Right? We use embody this way. All of these are great definitions. I would say many of the same things. They all share an interesting background assumption, which is that there is a thing that is not body. And I think that the word embodiment, as we use it, primarily is a relic not of the yoga tradition at all, but of the European tradition. And it's a relic of Christianity, which came in a very formal way into the doctrine that spirit and matter were separate, that your soul and your body were different things. And that all the doctrines around this, right, that the Holy Spirit comes into the body or came in, that the immaterial took form as Jesus, or that, the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak. This whole tradition that, and in philosophy too, right, Descartes says, I think, therefore I am. That was his big thing. And the way that actually plays out in philosophy is the assertion that there is a mind thing or a self thing or a thinking thing. Philosophers call it the cogito, because you got to say it in Latin, for some reason, that is not the body, and that there's this inseparable gulf between them. Inseparable. The opposite of that. The unbridgeable gulf between them. So then, several months ago, I got invited to give a talk at the Haas Business School at UC Berkeley, which was great. They were awesome. And they said, it was a talk, they were having people come in and talk about yoga and practice. And they said, we want you to come in and talk about the mind-body connection through yoga. And I came in, I was like, cool, this is a great topic. I have no idea what it means, right? What is mind and body as if they were two things to be connected? If we go to the Buddhist texts, what we get are lists of components of being that include, for instance, visual forms, the quality of perception, the nature of affect, things that are pleasant or unpleasant, thoughts and feelings, consciousness itself. And there's a recognition that some of these are descriptions of the kind of gross material level, and some of them are descriptions of things that are less material. But it's not asserted that these are absolutely two separate categories of things, where there's the mind and stuff over here, there's body stuff over here. In all of the lists, and there's lists of this in the yogas as well, there's a beautiful list called the tattvas, the elemental qualities. And it does delineate material qualities like the elements of hardness or liquidity or temperature or distance from the immaterial qualities of the sense of self or thoughts or perceptions. But it's not a divided binary. It's a system. So then embodiment as a word is a way to talk about, I would say, healing from a belief that we might have got from somewhere that mind or self or energy or spirit or soul are somehow separate from this meat form and need to be reconnected. And I think the main way that we notice this is that we do notice, many of us, that when we are what we might call lost in thought, like I'm just anxious and I'm spinning with the future. I'm just like, I want stuff to happen and I'm fantasizing and I'm dreaming about things and I'm like, oh my God, I wasn't even noticing that I'm hungry or tired or have a body at all, or I got totally into some intellectual problem and I lost track of the body, I was just thinking about the past, replaying an old conversation and getting lost in like trying to fix the past and what if I had said this and he had said that and she had said that and maybe it would be better. That's usually the punchline for me anyway. And this natural arising, what we call like the mind distracted, we think, like it seems like what we need to do is we have to bring our mind back into our body. That's the language we use, is we went out, we got to come back in. I was dissociated, you know, meaning I was daydreaming or something, and I had to come back into the body. And I think this language is useful, not because it's absolutely true in any way. The mind doesn't go anywhere, right? That's a metaphor. And what it's a metaphor for, I think, is a disruption in my sense of integrity or wholeness or intimacy with myself. So what if we take it away from the metaphor of distance, like I was out of my body, and we'll put in brackets here what we call out-of-body experiences, like I was floating on top of the hospital room looking down at myself having surgery. That's truly an out-of-body. Let's call that something else. Let's call that access to a bigger reality. But it's still a metaphor, right? Nothing went out. There's not a physical thing out there. That's a projection of certain kinds. The body is where the mind resides. Sort of. We'll put that, that's a footnote on the nature of the mind, which is not appropriate for a beginner's class. But just so that I'm not teasing, the footnote is that there's no individual mind. Mind is a communal, worldwide system, and there's only one of them on Earth. We'll talk about that later. But that's a vision of profound unity that mind is, that speaks to culture, etc. But what I want to get back to with embodiment is like, oh, there is this sense that I go out of the body, I get distracted, and I have these practices like breathing or bringing my attention into sensation or doing postures which force me to bring my attention into sensation and movement that do seem to do something really useful, which is they bring the thinking quality, the feeling quality, the attentional or focus quality, the perception and affect and consciousness qualities together into a more coherent experience. And coherent, we can think of as like experience where the senses have not been forgotten among the play of other content. And we can think of it this way, like, you know, like lots of us, I think now, I spend a lot of time on the computer. I'm writing things, or I'm doing emails, or I'm doing whatever. And the main practice that I want to do while I'm doing that, firstly, I want to just like not freak out or do it too long without taking a break. But the main thing that I want to do is I want to not forget my body when I do it. I want to sit in a way where I'm like, I can sense, this is like the felt sense that Andy mentioned, I want to sense my being here. And even as I'm talking right now, some part of my attention, this is my practice that I try to maintain, some part of my attention is not concerned with what I'm saying at all, but is resting in the shape of my body. Like I want to keep feeling the floor and the limbs and the weight and the temperature. Not because I need to somehow tether myself to it like I'm going to float off, although that is my tendency. Right? The metaphor is useful. It feels like that. The opening of one of James Joyce's stories that's collected, I think, in the Dubliners, it starts, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. So there's that. It's true. We do. But again, it's a metaphor. There's not actually two different things. So embodiment is a way of saying there's this whole body of practices that in various ways strengthen these different channels of experience. Sitting in stillness can help strengthen the channel of experience of attention and focus, right? How I learn to stabilize my perception faculty. and then how I learn to inquire or analyze into what I'm perceiving in order to perceive more and more accurately. Right? Sitting meditation isn't just to get calm and relaxed, but to learn to see more clearly. Right? So I sit, my mind wanders, I worry about X, I worry about something. And then I can do either two things with it, right? I can get wrapped up in the worry, and it plays on for a while, and I forget other aspects of my experience, like the body. Or I just notice that worry has arisen in the field of right now. And so there's a body, and there's breath, and there's sensations, and there's worry. And there's probably a sensation of unpleasantness. Or if I really feel into the worry, I might feel a kind of heaviness, or a contraction in the chest, or a shallowness of breath. Part of the attentional practice stitches together sensation and feeling, right? A feeling and a thought storm comes, and I feel the sensations that are right there with it. They're not separate from it, actually. I couldn't call it worry unless it came with a shortness of breath, say. And I've just learned this kind of shorthand called worry or anxiety, that if we take it apart, it means, you know, obsessive thinking about something with a negative feeling and some constriction in the body, which is how I know it's a negative feeling. They all come together. It's impossible to physically feel good and worry. I promise that's true. Try it. The physical practices, like of asana, especially modern asana, which I think is a very well-tuned medicine for an extremely disembodied culture, to go back into that metaphor, highly athletic asana, jumping around, strength poses, and strong stretches were virtually invented in the 20th century. Right? The early yoga texts don't have any of those. We'll talk about that later also. But the early practices had a lot more stillness and a lot more breath and energy to them. Along comes the post-industrial West, and we're like, how about push-ups? How about core work? How about crunches? How about moving until I sweat, until my whole world gets kind of warm and juicified? How about we do that while playing loud music? How about we do that while playing loud music and being in a really wonderful, hot room full of people? Or a wonderful room full of hot people. Right? All of these, I would say, are medicines toward embodiment, toward the senses, right? Can we please enjoy ourselves a little more? Can we please come into the body in a pleasurable way and make sensations stronger, because we need to notice something? So the asana practice drags us, and sometimes we need a very strong drag. So maybe you do something, you know, that's much more intense, you know, long intense holds or very hot practice or very intense practice, when that seems like the right medicine. Like, you know, I know people who did very intense practice and they were basically like, it's the only thing that brought me into myself, like that gave me a doorway into being here. But I had to just like, and I'll just say, like, I started in Ashtanga. It was totally exhausting. You know, my first Ashtanga teacher was Larry Schultz, who was this kind of kooky, does anyone know him in here? Yeah. This kind of radical bad boy of Ashtanga. I don't know how many people get to be the bad boy of Ashtanga. I'm sure there's several of them.
Yeah.
I know that there's several of them, but including the founder, but that's off the record. But Larry had this kind of wild thing. He invented these new series before freeform vinyasa was a thing. He basically invented it. He called it the Rocket series. Although at the same time as I was studying the Rocket series with him, I was also working at the high-end vegan restaurant Millennium in San Francisco, where we called arugula by the French name Rocket. So then I always wanted to have like the Rocket, R-O-Q-U-E-T-T-E series. Anyway, that's such a snobby joke. That's an in-joke in multiple streams of snobbishness. Sorry. But I found this practice and it was like, oh, this is totally impossible. Right, the full primary series was like 2.5 hours long. And you know, honestly, like halfway through, I was dead. Like I could barely hold downward dog. My arms are buckling. I just kept going back and going back and going back. And there was something that just like dragged me into contact with my senses. And so I'll say that this thing embodiment is, it points to something that's central to all the yoga traditions and in a certain way is implied by them and has to be amplified for some of us now in response to the conditions that we bring to our yoga practice. But that embedded in both these major traditions is an orientation toward experience that goes something like this. All at the same time is happening this flowering or abundant profusion of sensory experience. There's sights and sounds and smells and tastes and sensations and feelings and concepts and images and energies and breaths or winds that move through the body. And all of this is happening in the same container, right? That has in its most gross form, has the physical body and its sense organs. But then in subtler forms has the ways that we sense energy in relationship, the way that you know someone likes you or doesn't. There's immaterial senses. There's the way that if you closed your eyes, you would know whether you were alone in the room or not, right? We have senses that extend past the body, all right? There's the sense that you get when you sense God. Who knows how big that sense is? And in meditation or deep practice, attention can get very still, very spacious, and open into planes of, again, embodied sensate experience that are vast. Right? Some of the states in deep yogic practice have names like the beautiful, or the base of infinite space, or the base of infinite consciousness, or the base of nothing. And that sounds pretty abstract, so, you know, it is. But all of these things are sensations. They're all sensate. No one without a body does these in the way that we do them. So then embodiment is implicit in all the yoga systems. And we make it more and more explicit now because it's a good medicine for us. And as you go toward exploring the weave between, let's say, what I now just call stillness practices and movement practices, rather than separating Buddhist and Hindu yogas, at least always put the S on yoga. Say yogas, many, many yogas, many different kinds of practice that brings intimacy with experience. That between the stillness practices and the movement practices, orienting toward all of it as body shifts our orientation to them. And it can begin to unbind this ancient, I think, painful ideology that spirit and matter are somehow apart. So I'll pause there. As I said, all this month, we'll look at, from this kind of basis, we'll look at different specific elements of the relationship then between these two major systems. Take just a moment now before we go on to come again and again notice the language that we use that's built into our grammar to come again into yourself or into contact with yourself. And notice what you do to do that. Some of us have the habit, for instance, of adjusting our posture to a meditation posture. You don't have to. why would that be necessary? But but we learn in a certain way that the posture expresses or helps us or supports that coming together. And then just notice for a moment as you do that some of the qualities that are present in your experience right now that we might divide into body that has sensations, including breath, so it has movement. There might be thoughts or fields of concept as you digest what I'm talking about. Notice that there's a subtle sense of aspects of your experience being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And then for a moment, notice that all of this is perceived within a field. Of sensation. Let's do one more little experiment with this, which is if your mind is pretty quiet right now, think something on purpose. Think about something in your life. Or if your mind is wandering, just notice the wander and keep going with it for a little bit. Take a moment and make some thoughts. And then explore a little bit what thought is. What is a thought in relationship to this felt sense of your body? And now pause whatever thought you were doing, and you might open your eyes and see something visually in the room, like a spot on the floor or a color, and focus on that for a moment and notice what happens when you come out of discursive or image thought into a different sensation channel. And really focus on that visual thing for a moment. And then letting that go. And one last bit of experiment. Notice your mood or your like emotional tone and give a name to it. Label it in yourself as something. The label doesn't have to be precise, but find some single word or two words at most to describe your mood right now. And then as you do that, notice what it is you're tuning into that helps you give it that label. And particularly notice what aspects of that feel like sensation, what aspects of it feel like something else. How do you know what your mood is? Go ahead and let that go. And to open the last part of our time together, where we open into discussion, I'd love to just hear from a couple folks anything you noticed about that. So we just took a little look at essentially sensation, thought, and feeling, or what we sometimes call body, mind, and heart. Body, heart, and mind. Right. And the question really is, and I'm just so curious, I'm always curious to hear from folks what you find, What are those things, actually? What is thought? What is feeling to you? So anything you noticed in doing that? Andy.
I noticed that it's actually really hard to say what my mood is. Because when I go to look at all these things, it's so complex. It's like a little bit of unpleasantness there, but there's this pleasantness here.
So you're saying there's pleasantness and unpleasantness, but you kind of point to the body, so there's some sensations, right, that are part of mood. Lots of sensations.
Part of mood, and then there's kind of like, well, I know I'm not, having negative thoughts about things, so I'm kind of interested, so that's evidence for positive mood. Of course, this is getting kind of analytical when I start looking at it that way.
Right. Well, this is an analytical meditation, right? I'm asking you to actually notice something, think about it, give it a name. And it's hard, right? Partly, especially feeling. How many folks found labeling your mood or feeling to be a little difficult or subtle, right? It's often we only give names to them when they're strong, where they're like, oh my God, I'm having a grief attack, or I'm heartbroken and I'm on the floor. But subtle feeling, I do the same thing. I'm like, well, and sometimes I'll just ask myself, am I happy or sad? Really basic, my toddler right now, he has a book called The Feelings Book, right? And it shows little stick figures, and some of them are smiling, and some of them are crying, and it's like, sometimes I feel happy, and sometimes I feel grumpy, and sometimes I feel cranky, and he gets to learn, oh yeah, there's that, and there's that, So we have to learn this. That there's names for these things, but they're subtle. And they're really a mix of a lot of different things. What else? Someone else. Yeah.
It was interesting when I was trying to think about something and then moving into feeling, I noticed that, there is a spectrum. There's a continuum for a reason, at least for me, because the thoughts were very localized. It was an energy in my head. I didn't think with my big toe.
Yeah.
You know?
Or you don't think you did anyway.
I didn't notice it down there.
No.
But then when I went into feeling something, then my whole body came online. It's what is my mood? Oh, I'm irritated. How do I know that? Well, I feel this energy up my back. I feel this contraction here. I feel this heat this other place.
Yeah.
So it was much more my whole person. So I was okay, well, there's a reason we think these things are separate.
Yeah. So it's curious. I think how many folks would say in that same direction that when we say I'm having a mood or a feeling, a lot of what we're identifying is physical, is like sensation. What gives you the added information that these feelings, if there's a buzz or a heat or something, that it's an emotion rather than a sensation?
The emotion is just the label, right? They are just sensations.
So emotions are sensations.
The label of the sensation.
Right. So this to me is really interesting, right? This contradicts a lot of say Western psychology that would say sadness is this kind of complex of things, but we think of it as it's psychological, right? It's a mental thing. But when we investigate it, mostly we find sensations. I find the same thing. Right? And so what does that do for us or tell us about what feeling is? Feeling meaning emotions. Yeah.
It means that our mind can dictate that sensation. We can decide how we want to perceive it.
That's interesting, right? This speaks to the labeling thing, right? Because you could decide to label something, you could have different words for something, right? I might be for instance, sometimes when I get upset, because I've had a struggle to feel strong emotion, I have that conditioning. So sometimes if somebody really upsets me and I get this really uncomfortable kind of clenchy feeling in my chest, I get all excited because it means I'm feeling something. And I'm like, wow, sensations, it's all clenchy. Gosh. Whoa, that's cool. Gosh, I might even cry. That's amazing. oh my God, I hope it happens. Right? Because my concept about what that feeling means is colored by my conditioning, right? And so the label we learn to use is really important, right? The label could be, you know, I'm irritated and therefore I'm bad, or I'm irritated and therefore I'm powerful. And it could be the same thing, right? You could learn either of those, and you have learned one of those or some of those, depending on your family, your culture, your conditioning, right? You learn to experience a certain sensation as having a certain meaning. And this becomes a really interesting deconstruction as your practice goes on, right? To start being like, oh, I'm so upset about something. And you're like, what's actually happening? And you might describe it actually in sensation detail like you did and get all this detail like, oh, well, there's a contraction here and a heat here. And the instruction would be, cool, hang out with that. It's like, oh, it's just burning. It's just like doing this thing. And you hang out with it and it changes and it does its thing. And you're like, oh, well, that wasn't so bad. That was just heat and contraction, which is really different from I am miserable. Yeah? So part of our unlearning process and part of why analysis is needed is that we actually have to, if we want to be free of that particular kind of suffering, we have to unlearn those conditioned labels. There's a huge part of the kind of stilling the thought process, what Patanjali calls the citta vrittis in yoga, is essentially unlearning bad habits of mind, bad labels, basically, for things. And that unlearning, in Patanjali's method, largely takes the form of stilling them, like bringing them to substantial stillness. Anything else anyone noticed in exploring that? Yeah, Lisa.
I've had a bad mood for a few days and felt kind of insecure and dread. And then when I looked right at it, I couldn't really find it. Then I was actually reading this book.
What did you find when you looked? If you couldn't find that.
I couldn't really find much of anything.
Yeah.
But I was feeling fear.
Yeah.
Of not doing things right, of messing up, just not being enough. But I was reading this book about the five energies from the Vajrayana area, mm-hmm. Tibetan Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And in this one chapter, he kind of simplified it to, we've got energy that flows and energy that constricts and blocks. Mm-hmm. And that really meant a lot to me today because it was really clear that sometimes I was just flowing and sometimes I was resisting experience. Mm-hmm. And that simplicity really helped me.
It's nice because you can really feel it, right?
Yeah, that I could feel. And then there's just a very slight suggestion that, you know, there's a possibility that you could come from deeper and have the energy come from deeper and not block it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, for me, that kind of was really helpful, mm-hmm. that simplicity. And I felt like, you know, I could just come somehow from deeper, uh-huh. and just move through and flow with experience. If it was, oh, I'm resisting experience, and I've decided, well, no matter what this experience is, I'd prefer to flow with it.
Yeah.
And I had a choice there, which felt good.
Absolutely. And so then when you make that choice and you want to bring that choice into action, what does your body do to make that shift?
It allowed movement. It's like it came out of the contraction. I'm tempted to say I would take a breath. I don't know if that was true. But. Mm-hmm.
Undoubtedly, you took some at some point.
I'm still alive.
But my guess would be that there was some amount of like muscular relaxation.
Yeah.
That resistance comes through as muscular contraction. Like, we just don't move the joints as freely, you know, in a very basic
right.
way, including the breath, et cetera. And that some amount, that to allow experience is also to relax the body a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. But if I had thought of it in that way, I think I would have thought, oh my gosh, I have to relax. And it wouldn't have worked.
You got it.
I was thinking
you got
it more in terms of moving.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, which is good.
But I think the effect was probably the same.
Yeah.
Relaxing into it.
And, of course, and again, I want to point again and again to how the way that we talk about things can be both illuminating and challenging, right? So to say, like, relax is sort of like saying, like, have your mind give an instruction to your body to do something that it's not doing. And it's like, that's kind of annoying, right? But to come from somewhere of like, oh, what could I allow experience, or could I invite experience, or whatever verb works for your body, it can it could invite or allow or relax into or whatever it is, a different relationship to what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you for that. We can continue reporting, but as we have a little more time, also any thoughts or feelings, anything about this topic, or this is also just a space to inquire about or to speak to your own practice.
Being like, it's not like I ever stopped having physical sensations, or that feeling stopped, or that thoughts ever stopped. It was a matter of just, what am I bringing my awareness or my attention to at any given point?
Yeah.
And then that made me think about, when I was staring at that spot on the ground, what you're talking about, there's that seemingly duality, whereas we're sort of trying to get to integrity, or that integrated self.
Yeah.
And that just made me think about that, whatever is this observer, that's the one that's bringing the awareness to stuff, as opposed to my trying to fight myself, going, I'm too much in my head, I'm too much in my head, I need to drop in my body, drop in the body. It's more a matter of, like, it's not like I'm doing anything wrong, but it's like, where do I want to shift my awareness?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all happening, and just having that integration. I really like that word.
Awesome, awesome. This points, of course, to something very mysterious, right?
Yeah.
You're like, okay, all this stuff is happening all at once, basically. And the thing that I have choice about is where I point my awareness, where I shift my awareness to. Pay attention to thoughts, pay attention to sensations. Both fields of experience are happening all the time. And they're not even really separate, right? When I perceive the spot on the floor and my mind goes, that's a spot on the floor, that's both things at once happening, right? You can't... I'm sorry to say this. You can't perceive something without being perceiving, which is a mental quality, right? So, of course, it's all happening. So then, and again, this is more metaphysical than I want to go to tonight, but, like, then there's this thing called awareness. What is that? You know, what part of ourselves, our experience, does that abide in? Some of these traditions consider awareness itself to be the deity, that awareness is God or goddess. Some traditions consider awareness to be the constant ground of being. Everything fluctuates, but awareness doesn't. Some traditions consider awareness itself to be something that fluctuates, and that there is no thing that is the ground of being. Not even no thingness. And so then this question of, like, connecting with awareness, directing awareness, wondering what awareness is, identifying with awareness, disidentifying with awareness, all of these are positions within the yoga streams. And if you have access to it, right, the pathway toward access to it, as you're describing, is essentially this, like, come into the senses, then notice that you can direct your attention to different things. This already is a medicine for trauma. If you can do this, you are not lost in psychosis, which is a low bar, I know, right? But you got to, but not really in this world, right? Because actually, what that thing we call the mind distracted, that's all that is I wasn't not able to focus my attention in that moment. So it went to the thing that had the most charge, which is usually worry or fear or something like that, right? Hmm. Stuff happens all the time that has charge. If we are not consciously directing attention, it will go toward where the charge is greatest. Hmm. Sometimes that's a fine, good thing to do. Sometimes it's not that useful. So then the first practice is learn to direct awareness. And then as that gets deeper, learn to rest back into awareness as a ground and let everything come and go so you don't have to direct it as much. Then let go of doing even that. Right? That's the direction, should you choose to take the pathway. And then the different traditions speak about it very differently. Right? Are you resting into your own nature as divine? Are you resting into the external divinity who you're devoted to? Are you resting into things as they are, or your true self? I think ultimately that level of thing doesn't matter, what you call it, but the pathway goes from effort to less effort, and from direction to less direction, as it were. And you start to learn, like, oh, what is this thing unfolding moment to moment? So yeah, something like that. Other things? You had a question?
Mine's a little metaphysical, actually.
Ah.
Let's
get metaphysical. Metaphysical.
So, we talked about this a little bit before, but, like, so, I don't know, I was thinking about this in your talk, how, like, feeling more sensation, for instance, from doing something like intense yoga, it's like you're kind of creating a sensation in order to feel more.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if these meditation and sitting practices also have, like, this creative aspect to them, or if we're only noticing, like, what's there by refining our, like, want to call it awareness, more like perceivingness.
I love perceivingness. Totally. You're speaking to a distinction that I'll sometimes talk about as, like, it touches on, like, the volitional and non-volitional aspects of practice, right? There's some practices where I'm doing something, and there's other practices where I'm primarily observing. Are you observing or doing is kind of the split. And all the practices have both, right? So, like, if I'm sitting in meditation, part of what I'm doing is I'm sitting. I'm maintaining the posture, and if I'm doing the focused attention practice of any kind, I'm doing that redirection. Right, I'm doing the bringing my attention to a thing. But then, having done some amount of that, I'm also trying to strengthen this kind of autonomic observing quality, where I can see things without interfering with them. You know, and so some practices, you know, emphasize the observing side, like some kinds of pure vipassana or dzogchen or mahamudra practice emphasize, like, just do nothing. Some parts of Zen really do this. Soto Zen really does this. This gets really amplified, especially in the kind of East Asian traditions, because of Taoism. Chinese Taoism had a very strong, like, doing non-doing kind of thing, and that really created Zen. Other traditions, like modern asana, really do stuff, right? But while you're doing them, you're going to get again and again instructions like, you know, just notice sensation happening, or just, you know, allow the body to feel the pose. Try not to resist what's happening, you know. Or even when you just get instructions like, notice sensation as sensation, right? See if you can unhook from being like, this is painful, this is wonderful, but just be like, it's sensation. There's a burning sensation in my hip. That's a just observe instruction embedded within a very doing things kind of practice. So I think of the two essentially as a spectrum on which I would hope to for practitioners to find the place on that spectrum that's the right medicine for them at this moment. Right. If I've spent all my time being a striver, it's going to be important to do some non-doing practice. If I've spent all my time as a slacker, it's going to be important to do some doing practice. And that might, that'll fluctuate over the course of my lifetime of practice. It might fluctuate week to week. If it's fluctuating minute to minute through a sitting, we're a little unstable, right? And you want to do something stabilizing, wherever you are on that spectrum. But all of the practices can be seen through this lens of how much efforting or doing energy is there and how much observing or allowing energy is there. And we're always a little bit working that lever on the mixing board. Does that speak to that a little bit?
Something that's hard to point to it at that, and like about how much manipulating our experience like reveals reality or just creates reality.
Yeah, what to say? I mean, all of the main yogic systems tell us that in the realm of karma, which is how actions lead to their results, our volitional input into the stream of our lives is a relatively small percentage of what determines the future, right? Like, I can make a choice right now to do something, but what happens in the next moment is determined not just by that choice, but by everything that has ever happened in the history of the universe, right? I'm here because of my parents, I'm here because of the earth, I'm here because of Gandhi, I'm here because of Hitler, I'm here because of everything that's ever happened, stars exploding, big bangs, you know, Rama killing Ravana, everything is here. This is why mind is not individual also, right? And so like my volitional input is a little bit like, you know, at one point I was practicing and I was like, oh God, it's like this. I had this image of like a mountainside and like an avalanche of tiny pebbles, and they're all hitting each other, and it's just a flood of different things that seem separate, but it's actually just a mass of conditions. And at the same time as that's happening, there's a storm blowing them all around, and there's pockets in the ground where some of them are falling in and bouncing out, and it's just a chaos of action. And I could zoom way into a single pebble, and I have this little impulse where I can go that way, you know, and that affects the whole thing a tiny bit, and it affects my experience in the next moment. Or I can zoom way out and be like, whoa, I am just in the middle of an avalanche of motion. And when I first felt this on meditation retreat, and this is a classic meditation experience, I went into my meditation teacher and I was like, I'm having this sensation that I think is about karma, but that's too abstract, and I want to just tell you what it feels like. And he was like, what does it feel like? And I was like, it feels like I'm being pushed from behind, like physically. Like I'm not even doing anything, I'm just being pushed through my life. And I could feel it like a pressure on my back when I was walking. And it was just like, oh shit, I'm just like rolling along, and I have the tiniest little input into things. And that input is important, right? It's the only thing that you can do. But it's within the whole thing. And then the last thing I'll say, because this is time to stop, and it is the metaphysical thing that you're pointing to, I think, is that that raises a really challenging question about who's in charge. So we'll stop there. Because it's beginner's night, and we'll get to the utter absence of self. You know,
dropped a bomb.
I know. Well, you know, I drop that bomb all the time. It's the only bomb. It's the bomb this guy dropped, and it rings through all the yoga traditions. Right. The question is, or the proposal is, you're not who you think you are, right? And the thing that you think is making choices is not the thing that's making choices. And the sad punchline to it is, you have to keep making choices, nevertheless, which is really a pain in the butt. We will continue next week. We'll continue talking about the weave between these things. To folks that are new, welcome. It's great to have you. It changes all the time what we do. Mostly the structure is like we did tonight. We have a slightly longer time now than we did before, so we'll get to do a little bit more of like exercises and stuff. We do relational exercises sometimes, various things. So everyone's always welcome. This group has, one of the reasons that we are here in this space is that we operate fully on donation. So within a practice I call gift economy. And that means that the teachings are offered without expectation of return. And your offering of resources in the form of money or anything else you bring, seasonal fruit, etc., is gratefully received. And more than that, is actually the energy, of a manifestation of the energy that keeps it going, right? So there's a difference between the class having a price and being on gift economy. There's also a difference between it being free and being on gift economy. So the offer is that you offer your resources. The structure will be a little different here than over at our other space at Yoga Tree. The offerings will all go to the studio that will who will then pay me a set amount per person, which at the studio is $6 per head, which, given the average amount of donations, will work out to have me earning more than I was earning in the old system, where we split things half and half. But it means that if you get inspired by the Dharma and give $100, I will still only get $6 of it. But that'll be a good gift to the studio. So that's our new structure. Full donation, I get per head. And that way the studio both gets to support what we're doing, gets to offer the teachers, and this is just a general system that they do, offer the teachers more stability. And it maintains the principle of everyone being able to come regardless of income or resources. So everyone's always welcome, no matter your resources. And then your sharing of the gift of your resources makes it possible for the group to continue and be an offering. So you can give either through the desk, if you want to use cards and all of that, that's now fully embedded in the system that we didn't used to do, or you can give cash at the end of class as we always used to do that. And there's a box. Do you know where that box is?
I do not know where that box is.
So for tonight, we'll make the box this bell, which is also
a
classic thing to do. Use the basket. We'll use the basket instead of the bell. I'll put the basket over on the shelf over there, which is where we often would have it in the old space, and we'll figure out the formality of that as we go into the new system. Thanks for your flexibility, and as always, thank you for your generosity. Yeah. See you next week. Take good care.